This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, though for some reason today on a different ship, in a different time period, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, what's going on with your cap there?
Chris, I'm just playing around with Riker in the holodeck, okay. And we decided to visit the NX-01. And I love that they let them wear baseball caps there.
That's true.
And I thought that, you know, Sisko wouldn't mind too much because he's such a baseball fanatic that maybe bringing back the baseball cap to Deep Space Nine was a good idea. So I'm gonna test it out on the station today when we leave the holosuite. I mean, who knows how long Riker's going to be in there. But I figured I could come out and he wouldn't even know I was gone for like an hour while we record this podcast.
I guess so. Okay, so that explains why you are wearing an NX-01 baseball cap today.
Yeah, that and it just came in from Anovos, and been on pre-order for, I don't even know how long. So finally got it, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to record a Star Trek podcast. I'm going to wear this cool hat.
Very good. Well, I think Cassidy only lets Ben wear Pike City Pioneers caps, though.
I think that, or, you know, he had a few teams that he enjoyed from the olden days before baseball kind of died out for a while. True. I think she still allows him to wear those.
Oh, is that okay?
Yeah.
Because they're not active teams right now, okay.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, otherwise, it's kind of anathema around the Sisko house.
All right. Well, we're going to talk quite a bit about Sisko today because we're going to continue our series on the season 6 opening arc, which we're calling the Dominion Invasion arc. And today it's going to be Behind the Lines. But before we do that, we want to remind everyone that The Orb is part of the Trek FM network. So if you only listen to this show, if you're a DS9 fan and you just found the show and you're not familiar with the rest of the network, please check us out. We have about 20 different shows on the network right now. And we're covering every series in depth. We're covering topics surrounding Star Trek. And you can find those by going to itunes.com/trekfm or go to our website, trek.fm, and you'll find everything there. And you can also find us everywhere you get your podcasts, Spreaker, TuneIn, Stitcher, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. We're just all over the place. So be sure to check us out there. And if you want to share your thoughts on today's show, you can find us on Facebook in the Babel Conference, which is our closed listeners group. You just need to go there and click join. We have great discussions there. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field, and that'll take you right in. Or go to our website, trek.fm/contact, or find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Lots of ways to get in touch with us, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show. All right, Matthew, let's jump into our series here yet again, going behind the lines and talk about Sisko, talk about Quark, talk about Odo. We're jumping into just the middle of a story here. So what stands out for you first when we get into this part of the arc?
I kind of thought it was really interesting that, especially the first time watching through this, and obviously now we've seen it many times, but that they make Sisko a desk jockey.
Yeah.
With Admiral Ross, and they give him that desk job. And it just, it's so out of the blue because you never think about a Star Trek captain being put behind a desk. And the only time that's happened, it's been with Kirk, and it's not been a good thing.
Right.
So,
well,
if
you become an admiral, they'll stick you behind a desk. But if you're still a captain in rank, then typically not.
Yeah, and so it was just such an interesting thing to see, the fact that obviously admirals have other people work with them, and it needs to be somebody that they trust and think can do the job. And in a situation like this, in a wartime, you want somebody who has a strategic mind. And to me, this actually became one of the most important stories, I thought, for Sisko, in really showing the breadth of how good Sisko is, not only at his job as being a station commander, which is probably one of the most discombobulating jobs ever. I mean, all the things you have to keep track of.
Right.
But it shows the fact that Sisko is a big picture thinker, and it really became a frustration for me in the novels that Sisko was never made an admiral. It just made sense that this was the guy of all of the people in Star Trek. He's built to be one, and to be a good one. And so I think this is kind of genius. To Deep Space Nine has already been blazing so many new paths with Star Trek. It does it here again, and in a really unique and interesting way that helps this character grow and helps other characters grow on the show. And yeah, hands down, I think it's one of my favorite things that happens in Deep Space Nine, just because it's so unexpected. So, Chris, what did you end up thinking about it, especially when you first saw this and then the subsequent watchings?
That they were going to make Sisko a desk jockey?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was surprising, and listening to you talk about it, I think about the fact that you can look at it from two different perspectives as well. Real life, putting this man in that position during the war versus within Star Trek. Because within Star Trek, yes, we never think about them taking the lead captain, taking him off of the ship and putting him behind a desk and having him sit there while his crew goes off and carries out the mission. But I think what Admiral Ross noticed was that Sisko has a great strategic mind, and he's more valuable to the Federation in this situation in the Dominion War, helping Admiral Ross plan the strategy for the missions that the fleets are going to undertake, than he is commanding one little ship, the Defiant. And so it makes sense for me, from a strategic standpoint, that they would put him in that position. But as a TV show, it was very, very surprising that they would do that with our captain.
Well, Chris, I take offense to you calling the Defiant a little ship.
Okay, it's a tough little ship.
Yeah.
Does that help?
I'm going to be Worf here and grunt at that.
Little.
But yeah, I mean, you think of, you know, say a captain like Picard. You know, you have 1,000 people under your command that you're responsible for. But when you think about the responsibility that Sisko takes on here with Ross, I mean, he's responsible then with Ross for an entire tactical wing, and not just 1,000 lives, but we're talking probably tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives of all these ships that they're, and the lives of all the people that they're trying to influence and save throughout the Alpha Quadrant. So when you think about what Sisko is responsible for in Deep Space Nine and how many people he saves, he is almost single-handedly responsible for saving the Alpha Quadrant a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Not just, you know, like the planet, like Kirk and Picard, but the entire Alpha Quadrant. So it's pretty incredible what they
Picard
do here.
Picard did save the entire future by figuring out Q's puzzle and all good things.
This is true. Well, and I mean, he did save the entire Federation, you know, with First Contact. You know, we'll give it to him. But, you know, Sisko is one of those people that, in a very different type of way, and it's not glamorous. You know, he's not out there kicking ass and taking names. he's behind a desk figuring out the best ways to deal with this war, you know, and well, at least until he's influencing the prophets mm-hmm. to take care of, you know, an entire Jem'Hadar fleet. And I mean, that's all on him. So,
well, I think it shows where Star Trek, especially through these first three series, does a really good job of creating diverse captains. Because if Kirk, Picard, and Sisko were all contemporaries and they're all fighting in this Dominion War together, it really shows how each person can play a very different role. So here with Sisko, he is the strategist. He's the one that needs to be sitting there at command, figuring out what they're going to do. Picard is the person who you would want to be out there actually negotiating with people. He's more the face of the Federation because that's his temperament and that's what he's good at. Kirk is someone you would want carrying out those missions because he's always going to find a way to get it done and get everyone back safely.
And Kathy's just lost in the Delta Quadrant.
Kathy's looking for some coffee in the Delta Quadrant. So, now, I think Janeway would be more like Kirk.
Yeah,
and that's where I say through these first three series, I think they did a good job of creating more diverse captains. I feel like with Janeway, a large part of her character was an attempt to get back to the Kirk style.
Well, yeah. And I think what was most interesting was watching then, of course, and this is way off topic, but I'm wearing the Enterprise hat, so I'm going to bring in Archer. And the fact that he's the proto of all of them, so he has bits and pieces of all of them, and in kind of an amalgamation of everyone, which, you know, makes him so interesting. So, yeah, this is one of those things where Sisko really does stand apart again. I mean, he started off a commander, and then he became a captain. He was the first African-American, so he was standing apart in all those ways.
Yeah. On here, TV as a lead in Star Trek.
Yeah,
of course,
exactly.
In the fleet,
plenty,
by no means. Sure.
Yeah. But here, very interesting to watch them play this out. And I think what's interesting about the entire episode is that every time we're focused on any of the characters, we are learning more about them through what's happening to them and how they're reacting to it. And that's just good writing. You know, the fact that this is a 6-part series gives them the opportunity to let it breathe. And sometimes Star Trek could draw its seasons out a little bit too long, we've talked about. But here, at least, they're using that to the full advantage to really build a crescendo of an amazing, you know, finale that we'll get with Sacrifice of Angels. So really using their time wisely.
Yeah. Now, we will say that season 6 maybe is dragged out a little bit much because at the end we get Prophet and Lace and Children of Time back to back. And yeah, so
I just choked back a little bit, vomit.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should never bring up those two episodes to you when you're about to take a sip of a drink.
Chris, you like to do that to me? But this really is a cool thing to watch happen.
The other thing with Sisko here is that you can really see how much he cares about his crew, that they are family. I mean, he cares about his ship, but he also cares about the crew. The idea of sending his family off to do something while he has to stay behind is something that just doesn't sit very well with him.
And I love the scene that he has with Worf, because it really comes into play there. One, because it shows how close him and Worf have become because of the real transparency and the conversation that they're having there, I think is really cool. The way that Worf talks to him is the way that he talks to a friend, not just a captain. And you've never seen Worf like that. And I think that was really a nice touch. But two, the fact that he can tell how much this is weighing on the captain, where he says, I sense that this is very hard for you to stay behind.
I thought that was just something that he learned from Troy.
Yeah. Why did you have to bring that up, too? Jeez. You're bringing up all the worst things about these characters and the shows. But, I think that's one of the nicest scenes in the entire episode, and one I just, when I was watching it again, I was really responding to.
Well, it's good to hear you say that it connects with you that way, because I think that scene also can come off as, we need to get Michael Dorn in this episode for a minute. and he's off on the ship with Martok, so let's have him phone in.
It can't come off like that, but I felt like, even though they're obviously not in the same place at all, and they're, I bought the emotion of the scene of them together. Yeah. And I think the way that Avery plays it, because he's talking to the screen, it is really well done, and it matches perfectly with what's happening with Michael Dorn. And so, to me, it works. I'm not just going, oh, that's the scene where Worf phoned in.
Yeah.
Intergalactic Skype.
Yeah, yeah. But it works way better than terrestrial Skype does.
Oh, geez. No kidding. He didn't have to call three times.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll end up talking about Sisko a bit more as we go along here. But another character that's, well, not just one character, actually, but Quark's change of heart is very important in this episode, and that's something that Armin Shimerman has talked about before, the fact that he likes this episode because it shows how Quark wakes up to reality and realizes that just running his bar is not enough. And he's also finding here that he can't run his bar in the way that he wants because his customers are Cardassians and Jim Hadar now. But also, for someone who has spent the whole series thinking that maybe life would be better without the Federation around, now he's ready to bring the Federation back. And beyond Quark, his brother as well, I think that seeing how the Ferengi are in this episode is really interesting because so many people don't like the Ferengi and they skip the Ferengi episodes and they think that, well, maybe Star Trek and maybe DS9 would be better without Ferengi around. The Ferengi are so important to what's happening, at least Quark and Rom, these two Ferengi are so important to what's happening here.
This is a really great episode for both of those characters. And what I love is that Quark's statements about the Cardassians and the Jim Hadar and about business, you know, that kind of subtle bigotry he has towards those two groups is something that we completely understand. You know, like, the Cardassians are mean. I don't like them. And the Jem Hadar, they're no good for my business whatsoever.
This is, and they're creepy.
They just stand there like statues. Yeah. And, but I but love
the other
that.
Great thing about that, though, is that Quark's drunk. And you know how people speak more honestly when they're inebriated. He's just staring out. He's like, I don't like Cardassians. I don't like Jim Hadar.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that it's just the honesty. It's a really interesting thing to see Star Trek do, to allow them to say, we're going to kind of vilify certain races and you're going to accept that it's okay. That's a really new thing for, I think, Star Trek to do, is say, mm-hmm. this race is kind of irredeemable, at least for the moment.
Well, at least with a race like the Cardassians, who they've really fleshed out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. It's not like TOS Klingons, where we don't get to see the Klingons enough to really know that much about them. We just know a few specific Klingons, like Korkang and Koloth. And you can tell us, well, the Klingons are the bad guys. And you'll say, okay, I get it, the Klingons are the bad guys. But here, because we've gotten to know so many Cardassians, then making that statement about them is different.
Well, and not only that, but they're going to continue to build on that. Mm-hmm. So that by the end of the seventh season, the way that you view Cardassians is terribly different. You know, especially, again, with Dumar, who is a complete jerk in this episode. We can't stand him. And yet, by the end of the series, we're going to love him. And so there's always a nuance with Deep Space Nine. It's never the black and white. It is, you know, the Gray's Trek. Everything is gray. And it can either shift towards the good or shift towards the bad, but that depends on the choices that a certain character or a certain group makes.
Yeah.
And so I think that that is what makes Deep Space Nine just feel so much closer to us, because we can understand the fact that, yes, things are gray. They're not all mm-hmm. black and white. And there's more nuance to life than just we have the bad guys and the good guys, because we're going to watch different characters go from one side to the next.
Well, let's go back to the bar scene with Quark and Damar. What did you think about Quark's decision that he was going to use the really good Kanar? Because he was going to give Damar the cheap stuff initially. But once Quark makes the decision, like, okay, I'm going to get drunk with this guy who I can't stand and see what I can learn and see what I can do to help. So there's this moment where, especially after the big fight in the bar and Quark gets thrown across the bar at the beginning, there's this moment where it snaps for Quark and he's like, okay, I'm going to do something now. I'm not going to just sit back anymore.
I like that moment because it's so organic for him. You know, he's using his
skill, his best skills, right, to help the cause.
He's created a relationship with Damar, and in some ways I feel like he's been doing it on purpose. You know, Damar comes in every day, he gets the Kanar, and Quark can see that something's different about this guy, and that can't bode well if I want to be back in business with the Federation again. And so what I love is that Quark's selfishness are actually leading him to be selfless at the same time. It's not all black and white. You know, there's many different reasons for what Quark's doing, but in the end, he's doing the right thing for the right reason and the wrong reason, maybe. Is that, you know, like, it's not all altruistic, Federation style, but it's still much different than where Quark's been before. And what's nice is that it doesn't feel surprising. So if you've been paying attention to Quark over the five seasons and now into the sixth season, watching him finally make this decision is not shocking. You're like, oh,
yeah,
finally.
Yeah, it's a very natural flow. Absolutely.
Yeah, he wants to serve root beer again, and who doesn't?
I love that line. I want to serve root beer. Armin said about this in The Companion, he pointed out, of course, that in A Time to Stand, Quark says the Dominion's not all that bad. Having them here is not all that bad. But about what happens in this episode, he says, Quark is one of those deluded people who thought, this is fine, we all get to do what we want to do, and didn't realize that liberty was more important than creature comforts. But he learns, and I was very appreciative for that aspect of the arc. Like any everyman character, Quark has to go through some turmoil before he realizes the truth. And I think that's true. He does go through the turmoil. But it's not just the turmoil, though. It's the influence, as we talk about on here all the time, the influence that each character has on each other character. Being with this crew of Federation officers and Bajorans, it has rubbed off on Quark over time to the point where he realizes the truth as well.
Yeah. I mean, and I think part of it is that in some ways he's created relationships and friendships with these people, and he hasn't been able to do that with the new occupiers of this part of space. And they don't care to do that. And that's the thing, is they don't care to do that. Not what they're here for.
The Jem'Hadar don't invite you to the poker game, Matthew.
That is true. And they cheat. So, I mean, I just don't like playing with them.
Let the Jem'Hadar win.
Yeah, otherwise he pulls your legs out of your sockets.
That's right.
So.
And Rom in this episode, I thought that Rom was just great.
Oh gosh, when they're talking and he's all, no, Rom, the deflector, and he's like, oh, yeah,
What do you think? I'm glad it wasn't me.
and then he, you know, talking about, and then coming to the realization that it just makes a ginormous anti-graviton beam.
That's the thing. He's like, there's no way they could shut this down. And he goes through the whole process. And then it's like if you're writing a piece of software and there's some just obvious gaping hole in it, some huge security flaw, but you never think about it as the programmer and you put that out there. And that was sort of watching his thought process was like, I created the perfect... Oh, crap. There's this really easy way... to take this whole thing down. And they're like, why didn't you think about that when you were designing it? I don't know.
Well, and what's what actually I thought was most interesting is wasn't that Rom hadn't thought about it, was just the fact that apparently it's a solution that takes somebody that's pretty genius to figure out in the first place. And so that's why it's taken the Dominion so long to get there.
Maybe. But at the same time, as Rom is going through the steps of how the mines work, and then he goes into the steps of what you could do to modify it to take the field down, I'm thinking Geordi, Data, Miles, any of these guys, B'Elanna, would just be like, bang, 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 here's your solution. It felt like it's how Star Trek takes the tech. And the fact that Rom could create the minefield without ever realizing that it could be taken apart this way, that was a little bit surprising to me.
Yeah. I think it just makes for a funny moment. And good thing
it is make for a funny moment. It's very funny.
The Cardassians trying to figure this out. The Cardassian men, as we know, they're not the scientists. And so apparently they haven't had their female scientists working on this. And if they had, maybe they would have figured it out faster. But apparently Dumar has been heading it up. And well, by this point in the show, he's kind of drinking a lot. So
yeah,
he's not really at the top of his game.
You know, the drinking is interesting because what the writers said about that is that they wanted to have Dumar start having this drinking problem to show that there was something not right with him, but that it's not because he's an alcoholic, but because he has a conscience. And so something's eating at him, and so he started drinking to kind of, as a way of coping with that, which is really different than just having like a two-dimensional bad guy who just is drinking all the time and running around and the station as a drunkard. No, this is someone who there's something going on in his head and he needs a coping mechanism, and the coping mechanism is the Kanar. And I think that plays out really, really well when you get into the final chapter. As you remember, there's that moment where, I mean, he's really downing the Kanar. And then he throws the Kanar into the mirror, which is the moment where it really snaps for him that he needs to do something to save his world from the Dominion.
Yeah, it's a nice thing because this series is really going to build on itself to the point where he makes the huge mistake of, spoiler alert, shooting Zial.
Yep.
And that just builds into then throughout the end of this season and into the next to that moment that you just mentioned. And so it really is something nice that it's nice to see that the writers had actually kind of started planning that on purpose to use it as they were moving forward. And it seems like that may be one of the things that they really had a handle on with the Dumar character of, okay, where we want to take this guy.
Yeah.
We're going to have you hate him now, but you're going to love him in the end, I promise.
Yeah. Well, it's they're creating yet another very interesting villain for the series, just like they did with Dukat and just like they did with Wynn.
Yeah, and it's what's more interesting, I think, I find Dumar a much more interesting character because I never personally buy that Dukat isn't anything but a megalomaniac.
Yeah.
But Dumar, on the other hand, he is this character who feels like he's a true Cardassian. He is there for Cardassia. He believes in Cardassia. And then, of course, just like Garak, in the end, realizes that that Cardassia probably needs to die a horrible death so that a new one can rise from its ashes, like the Phoenix. And so I find that so much more interesting because he really does become the true patriot. And what's funny is to watch the fact that Quark kind of becomes a patriot in this episode. You know, like he finds something that he believes in more than just making money. It's about who he wants to make money with, like who he wants to be partnered with in life, you know, and that it's not just about making profit, but it's about who you're making profit with. And are they fun? You know, like, are these people you want to be with in your life? And I love the way that Quark's, you know, little heart grows three sizes this episode.
Well, that's a good point, right? That who you do things with and whether you enjoy what you're doing is more important than the money, really. I mean, you need the money to live, but if you're doing it just for the money, it's not going to last long. And I think that's something Cork realizes here. Odo is such a good story for Odo and the female changeling showing up, the first time in a long time for her to appear on the show. And really, it really, really tests Odo's loyalties. I guess the question is, are Odo's actions shocking to you in any way?
They aren't now. Because I think after watching the show a few times, I've come to accept that for a lot of the show, Odo is pretty morally ambiguous.
Oh yeah, that's
in the sense
true.
That he has a sense of justice, and that's it. But he doesn't have the moral center or the connection with anything else other than this vague idea of almost like platonic form of justice. That's his god, basically, is the platonic form of justice. Like, he realizes it's there, and that's what he's beholden to. But he's not beholden to any specific race or anything else, even his own race, really. And so, because of that, to see him kind of be manipulated by the female changeling to say, this isn't about the solids, this is about you and what you want. You know, it's when you don't have a good foundation, and Odo doesn't have one, not just because he's goo, but, you know,
so you can't have a solid foundation if you're goo, is what you're saying.
Well, that's kind of really against the changeling theology of having a solid foundation. But yeah, I think that's, you know, he doesn't have that foundation that his life is built upon, and therefore... Yeah. It's easy for something like this to happen, and the more you watch it, the more you realize that Odo is—he's got a sail up, and he's got no anchor anywhere, you know. And so he just kind of blows around, and he's a lonely little puppy. You know, he'll go with whoever starts to really give him attention.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think he goes with whatever he's surrounded with. That's why he was able to work on the station with the Cardassians originally, then with the Federation and the Bajorans, now again with the Cardassians. And it's why in this situation, he's not really on either side. Like, he doesn't want to betray his friends, but at the same time, he's not really sold on the whole Federation Bajoran ideals either. It's just, okay, well, whoever's running the station right now, I'm going to do my job. I don't necessarily see him as like a puppy that whoever gives me attention, I'll go with them, because I do feel like he's his own person. I was going to say his own goo, but he's his own person or being here. And he's kind of separate from everything else around him. I think that I'm not sure that he would be that much happier being a part of a group than he would be just being by himself. That's sort of my feeling about him. However, what he does have going at this point is a growing relationship with Kira. He's getting closer to Kira. And he also, I feel at this point, knows that he's appreciated by Sisko and the other members of the crew. So for the female changeling to be able to shift him by telling him things like, it's about you and it's about where you come from and it's about what you could be, it has to be something more than the traditional. Like, if you were, even with Worf, for example, being a Klingon growing up on Earth, yeah, there's the call of home, but it's still what we're accustomed to as physical beings being in different places. Your environment might be different, but the nature of your existence doesn't really change that much. But what they offer him here is the Great Link, and they really go into the Great Link quite a bit, although they never settle on any real detail of what it really is. They kind of try to have it both ways, right? But the fact that from the very beginning of the series, we know that Odo was searching for his people. Now he's been through the process of being turned into a solid, back to a changeling. And now the female changeling is offering him the chance to really experience what the Great Link is and answer some of those lifelong questions that he's had, and to show that the nature of existence for them is just totally different than what he's accustomed to. That element of it, to me, is very, very important for making Odo turn the way he does in this episode, because otherwise I would still be very surprised in the sixth season that he would betray everyone the way that he does.
I think that it is very much the... When I said, like, a little puppy, I think I was thinking more like the idea that he's the lost puppy. I mean, that he is one of the 100 who's been sent out, and he does have that instinctive longing for home, for the Great Link, and he's never been able to satiate that, and here is his opportunity to be able to do that. And it does feel like, I can't say no to this. And it's interesting, if you're watching the episode, especially as watching it tonight, it's irresistible to him. He can't stop. He can't, you know, the female changeling even asks him, do you want me to stop? And he doesn't even say anything. He can't. He's drawn to this thing that he's never had. He's experienced a couple of times, and he just kind of wants more. I think it's a really powerful thing, and it is the only thing that kind of makes it make sense a little bit for him to betray everybody else. Mm-hmm. And again, when you take into account the fact that Odo, he doesn't have the firm foundation that everybody else kind of has in the Alpha Quadrant of who they are, where they've grown up, kind of what they believe in, all of that. You strip all that away, you can understand why, okay, Odo's maybe thinking, oh, maybe I finally found that thing. Maybe this is where I belong, you know? And so it's still rough to watch, but it kind of makes a little bit of sense, even if it's still not the right decision, we don't think.
And of course, they ended up making it a sin of omission, which is that he did not run the scan so that Rom could get in and do the work. Not intentionally, but just because he got lost in this moment with the female changeling and he didn't go to his office and he didn't run the scan. But the original version of the story had him actually turning against everyone, and he would have been the person who arrested Rom, and he would have actively tried to stop the resistance movement. If they had gone that way with the story, would that have worked for you, or would that have been too much of a leap in changing the nature of his character and his relationship with everyone?
There is a wonder if there's some brainwashing going on here.
Do you feel like there's brainwashing? Because Kira feels like there's brainwashing.
The Odo's reaction after it, you know, she's like, did it upset you? And he's like, no.
He seems
it's
like he's on
like
drugs,
he's high.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like that they're... It's either an aspect of something that comes from the Link that he's not able to fully appreciate or experience or understand the effect it's having on him, which could make sense because Odo does say earlier, and I don't think he's just trying to not Link. He's saying it's overwhelming for me. And, you know, when they describe the fact that the Founders are, and as a species, they are a drop in the bucket, and they are the ocean at the same time.
They're the ocean, and they're a drop of the ocean at the same time, right?
Exactly. It makes a little bit of sense to think that she's able to influence Odo in a way that he's just not even cognizant of.
Yeah.
Like, to lose himself, and not of anything that he's necessarily done other than the fact that he's... This is kind of what it means to be part of the Link. You do lose a little bit of yourself into the Link, and maybe it takes a while to get more of that personality back when you pull out.
So are you saying that after joining with the female changeling here, that it sounds like Odo's behavior could be attributed to the fact that he's sort of lost a bit of himself in the Link, and it takes a while for him to figure out purely his own identity and his own position again.
Yeah, almost in the way that you kind of get maybe lost in a relationship at the very beginning, yeah. Like a love relationship, and you kind of maybe become a different person and you don't even realize it.
Well, everyone says somebody's that like, this person yeah. became a different person in that situation, right?
Right. So yeah. I kind of think that that might be happening here with Odo, and it makes sense when you're literally sharing your physical nature with each other the way that, you know, the founders do in a very gooey way.
You had to add that at the end, didn't you?
I just wanted to see you laugh.
So a lot of fans took the scene with the female changeling as being a sexual scene, although it's been said that it's not intended that way. But then LeVar Burton, who directed this, said that no, it's definitely a sex scene between them. But when Odo describes it to Kira, I think he basically says that Kira is upset about maybe the female changeling is going to find out about our plans by joining, because like you can read your mind or something. And Odo says, and Kira says, and she's manipulating you. And Odo says, no, the Link isn't about exchanging information. It's about merging thought and form, idea and sensation. I mean, doesn't that sound like what intimacy is in the first place?
Sounds like really bad changeling porn. Just really what it sounds like.
That's going to be on the back of the box.
But they don't have a box, Chris. Yeah,
right. I'm just picturing the like the golden humanoid shape, and then text says, merging thought, form, idea, and sensation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, goodness. It is a really, I mean, it's just a weird thing to think about. And there's no reason for it not to have some sort of undertones that way. When you
well,
think
should,
about
really.
That this is there as close as humanoids can kind of get to being joined, you know, changelings take that one step further. And of course, there's probably some sort of, we're just going to keep it PG. There's some sort of something that happens that creates an intimacy there that goes way beyond just anything that we can even think of.
It is interesting that Odo says it's not about exchanging information, because as the conversation goes on with the female changeling about the nature of the Great Link and who the founders are, it has to be about exchanging information. Because, you know, they go all Obi-Wan on us at one point, where there's one and there are many, depending on how you look at it, right? This is the truth and the reality from a certain point of view. But if from one point of view, there's this one ocean and all the founders, all the changelings are part of this one being, how could it not be about exchanging information? Wouldn't they all be aware of everything?
Yeah, I don't think that Odo is being completely truthful. And I don't
Or
even
maybe
think
he just
Odo,
doesn't understand.
Yeah, I that's the other thing. I think that when it comes to the ideas and how it works to be a changeling, he's like a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
So, you know, why would you ask him? Because he can barely utter words in the first place in changeling, let alone tell you how it works. And so I don't think he understands how it all works. And we never really get the answer other than to say that when this kind of wraps itself up, Odo basically kind of says, I'm back. Like, I'm back to being myself. And so it does seem like he loses a part of who he is in this whole pseudo-sexual thing. And it always made me wonder, Chris, do you think that the female changeling, you know, realizes obviously that Odo is a part of this resistance cell and that this is intentional, or does she not even care at all about this resistance cell that Odo's kind of a part of?
I think that it's most likely that she just doesn't care because she doesn't see things as a threat. she sees herself, because naturally, as a shapeshifter, she is superior to the solids. So she doesn't really see them as a threat. I think all the way to the end of the war, until they finally walk into that command center and she's the last one there and she can't fight back, I think she always feels like everything's going to work out in my favor because I'm better than all of these solids in the first place. It seems like after joining with Odo for sure, she would have to know, in my opinion, she would have to know about the resistance cell. And it is suspicious that she shows up there in the first place, that maybe she has some idea that something's going on, or at least she's suspicious of Odo being around the solids. But I just don't buy the whole idea of there being no exchange of information. I think that after they join, she would have to be aware of the fact that there was a resistance cell and that Odo was part of it.
Yeah, I feel like that's just misinformation. Yeah.
But she would not care, and she would not make it a thing, because strategically it would be better for her to have this information but not let Odo or anyone know about it.
Well, all I know is that it makes Kira one angry major.
Yes.
And all I've got to say is that I'm pretty sure that Odo's going to have to get that doorbell fixed outside right. his quarters, because that thing ain't working anymore.
No. But what stands out to me here, again, and this happens so often here late in DS9 when I watch this, is just Nana Visitor is so good. The emotion that she pours and the believability that Nana Visitor puts into this role is just off the charts.
Off the chain, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's really, she is a fantastic actress, and I think that the heart and soul that she pours into Kira is one of the things that makes her stand apart from kind of the conversation that people have about whether they like her or Ro better.
Yeah.
I love the way that Nana plays Kira and the arc that she goes on, and here she is mortally wounded in spirit because Odo is the person that she feels like she can trust the most on this station.
Yeah.
And he betrays her, and she has these latent feelings for him as well that have been building.
Yeah, that's
and
the
so
other thing.
All of that, it's a betrayal of everything that they have been so far. And everything they might be, at least up to this point. And so, you thought she was yelling about a wormhole. This is this is way worse, you know, when it comes to Kira tantrums.
Yeah.
And she has a good reason to be angry.
Yeah. I mean, it's not exactly a tantrum, because she has a very legitimate reason why she's upset. Do you feel that it's equally because he has endangered the resistance movement and because he has betrayed her on a personal level? Or do you think it leans more to one side or the other? Because the emotion behind it is I really feel that Kira really cares about Odo, and that she feels betrayed by someone who is, at least in a growing way to her partner, at least in her mind, at least emotionally somewhere, even if she doesn't want to own that yet.
Yeah, I do think that it's a wonderful combination and a toxic combination of all of it.
Yeah.
Because Kira is somebody that her personal feelings at this point, she's able to control them more for the sake of what's happening, the mission. And she's done it before. She's tapping into her reserves from what happened during the occupation, and understanding, especially since they had, you know, we had that huge conversation about when her and Odo had been kind of tamping down the resistance idea, and then they have their eyes opened. You know, Kira is in full resistance mode now.
Yeah.
I mean, that switch is flipped, and therefore what Odo does here is collaborate. And when you think about how Kira felt about collaborating, and this is somebody that's so close to her, again, she just, I think she feels betrayed on every single level possible. And so that emotion comes out on that doorbell.
Yeah. You know, before we completely move off of this overall scene here, actually, it's not the scene, but it happens at the end of the episode. We were talking about whether the female changeling is trying to manipulate Odo. The final line in this episode is very unusual, I think, to end an episode that way. But when Kira comes in and talks to Odo, there's a moment where you think maybe that's the female changeling and not Odo. But then Kira leaves and the female changeling comes out from behind the wall. So, okay, so it was really Odo. But when she asks Odo, did she upset you? And he says, no, not really. And the final line of the episode is the female changeling going, ah, that just like this. That's where it feels like, yeah, she's got a plan here. She is trying to manipulate Odo. And she sees that things are working in her favor now.
She's got her whatever changelings have and you know, because they don't have hooks, but right. she's got whatever it is in Odo at this point. There is something going on here that's way beyond just trying to teach him about being a changeling. Yeah. And I do think it's because at this point, obviously, she's gotten a whiff of what's going on and what Odo's been a part of. And Odo does have the ability to change the course of the future with his abilities as a changeling.
Yeah.
And she knows that. So I do think there's an element of control, especially by the end of this episode happening. And you remember the second time they merge together, they you know, enter the Great Link together, they're literally getting the call from Kira of, Odo, are you doing what we planned on? You know, so it's not like she's not very cognizant at this point that Odo's been part of a resistance movement.
Well, two other quick things here before we wrap up. We don't need a big discussion on them, but Damar and Kira, the relationship here, I think it sets up beautifully what happens to them at the end of the series. So this abrasive relationship that they have, very short with each other, pays off at the end when they have to work together. So that's a nice setup. And then the other thing is Dax. We didn't talk about Jadzia, but she gets to take command of the ship. We see the relationship between her and Sisko again, which once again, we had this, I think this was on the Babel conference recently, where someone, we were talking about, is Benjamin friends with Jadzia? We said, no, really, Benjamin is friends with Curzon. And this is where the trust that he has in her to carry out the mission, and then the little exchange that they have as he's leaving the Defiant before they go away, felt a lot more like that closeness between him and Curzon to me.
Huh. I would never have said that.
I just threw it out there.
Yeah, you threw me for a loop.
Their relationship feels a lot deeper than just the captain and commander who have been working together for a few years in those moments.
Yeah. I think with a joint trill and with them having the access to somebody they've already known before, there is a depth that happens that goes beyond, obviously, just Jadzia and Sisko. There is something else there. But I do think that, to me, that one, that conversation was a great combination of what happens when you know a joint trill and you've known them before. That it is a wonderful, kind of ethereal, strange thing where you're mm-hmm. really talking to both. But at the same time, I think his trust is in Dax, Jadzia Dax at that point, not just Dax.
Yeah, okay.
Because
yeah, I'll agree with you on that.
She's a formidable person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not just because she used to be Curzon, but it's because of who Jadzia is. And
yeah.
I think that came to play when she is holding the phaser array. which I love. How does somebody does Ensign have to go in there and like stack those back up every
I was
time?
Because the same thing. I'm like,
because, is there a force field that holds them
right,
there?
Because you have to carefully place it on the wall so it doesn't fall over.
Yeah.
Now in battle, how do those things stay there, right? So yeah, before the ceremony, do they like set them all back up? I guess that's what they do.
Do you know how many times that Nog has had to replace the glass on the bar top there because those things have been flying around? Maybe inertial dampers help keep those where they. I have no idea.
But, I don't know.
I liked to me that too that scene, where he kind of sees her and. You know, doing the thing that he used to do on the ship.
Yeah.
There's such a respect there, I think, that he has for this woman.
Yeah.
Who used to be a friend that he used to know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that it's all mixed up and you can't really tell. And I don't think it really necessarily matters because they are so close.
Yeah. Yeah, it is complicated. I think that it is Jadzia who he has the trust in to command the ship and carry out the mission. On an emotional level in that scene, I feel this connection too between him and someone who he has known for so much of his life, and that would be Curzon there. But we can have another discussion about, we've had one before, and we'll have another one down the road about the nature of that relationship throughout the series when you see them confiding in one another. The scene, though, where Jadzia's doing the thing about this means something, for me, that scene doesn't quite work. It's the way Terry Farrell plays it. It's too soft and too cutesy. Like, the way Sisko does it at the beginning, there's this gravitas to it. And if you're under his command, you're feeling, this is the leader who's always going to guide me home. And I believe that Jadzia is that same kind of leader, and I have that trust in her as the captain. But the way that she holds it up, the way that she says it, it's a little bit too much of the playful Jadzia who is going to be wearing a towel when she answers the door to her quarters. Just the delivery of that line by Terry Farrell here, it falls flat for me. But I do agree with what you're saying about Benjamin and Admiral Ross watching her do it and what it means and the pride that Benjamin feels in seeing Jadzia do that and knowing that he has helped nurture another person who is a great commander and a great leader.
I love, too, that for anybody who, you know, is a little upset with the way that you can become a captain in the JJ-verse, well, this can happen in Prime Universe, too. You refer to the person who's sitting in the chair that's been getting command of the ship as captain. O'Brien said it.
Yes.
So, therefore, it's canon, guys. So, when Pike does it to Kirk in the new Star Trek, he's just following O'Brien's lead. So...
That's right. Even though O'Brien comes later on the timeline, but you know they've watched the tapes from the future.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, the best part about that is when O'Brien tells Nog, like, by the time you had to take command, there would be no one left to call you captain.
Yeah, it
and
was
Nog
not even
is
a
like,
matter.
Good one, you got me there.
He's like, oh yeah, right, crap.
All right. Well, I guess we've run through, you know, all the major points here of this episode. When you jump into the middle of a story like this, there is really no start or end to the story or the discussion, but it's good
thing,
to jump around.
The great thing is, Chris, is that what's so nice about this is that there's such depth of what's happening with the story that you're not feeling like, oh, I'm just stuck in the middle. No, you're by this point, sixth season of Deep Space Nine, you're so invested in these characters. What we're learning about them in this episode makes it all worth it. So it's not as though we're like, oh, I can skip that one.
If you skip this one,
you're going to be in real trouble.
Right. You're like, I love DS9. I love that season 6 opening arc. I've seen all the episodes except for Behind the Lines. I skipped that one because it had Ferengi in it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're skipping this one because it's got Ferengi in it, you're going to miss a huge amount of growth here for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, next time we come back around to this particular series that we're doing, we'll be talking about Favor the Bold, which, as we said on the other side of the orb, Matthew, is not Favor the Bald, even though Sisko is bald in the episode, as he is in most episodes.
Yeah, and it would be cool if it was that, because all of, you know, my friends that I know that don't have hair would feel much better about watching this episode.
Yeah, and I would feel better as well, since my hair is becoming thinner by the day.
It's
by
okay.
The month
here. You look great, Chris.
That's because you can't see me from behind. All right, but yes, it will be Favor the Bold next time we come around to this, which will be about a month from now. We'll have other episodes of The Orb for you in the meantime, including an Orb of Mail, which will be coming up pretty soon. So if you have anything that you want to ask us about Deep Space Nine, it doesn't have to be about this particular episode. It's just DS9 in general, anything we've talked about on The Orb, or anything we haven't talked about that you would like to hear our thoughts on, send us a message. You can ask us by email, trek.fm/contact. You can ask us on Twitter. You can ask us in the Babel Conference. And what we do is we save those questions up, and then periodically we do a special listener feedback episode called The Orb of Mail, and that'll be coming up pretty soon. So, Matthew, tell everyone a little bit more about the Babel Conference, which we keep mentioning.
Well, Chris, the Babel Conference is our listeners-only discussion group, and what's great about it is that only listeners do know about it. So I think that's what makes it so special, and it gives us all an opportunity to get together and talk about the things that we talk about here on Trek FM, and that's what makes it so enjoyable. You know, we talk about all the things we talk about on all the Star Trek shows, and then, of course, the 602 Club, so it's a great place to have a good conversation online, and surprisingly enough, it's one of the nicest places to have a conversation online. We have very respectful conversation, so I hope you'll join us there. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook, or you can go to the website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar, and any of our hosts there will let you in, and you can join in the conversation yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great, great group. There are a lot of people there. We're up well over 700 now in that
discussion. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Group. So, yeah, it's quite nice. So, hope you'll join us over there. Now, Matthew, when you're not creating fruit baskets to hide tools in and carrying them around to your friends, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek, which is fun because we talk about a lot of Deep Space Nine books as we are wrapping up pretty soon the Deep Space Nine relaunch series, finally. And we talk to the authors, do interviews. It's just a great place, honestly, to get the Prime Universe these days and get a fix for your favorite characters with, new adventures. You can find me on the 602 Club talking about all things geeky. We choose a great new topic each week and try to introduce ourselves to something we might not have tried before, or might not be something that everybody knows, or it could just be something that's new that just came out in theaters. So check us out there. You can also find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. And, of course, you can find me on the Twitter at MattRushing02, and you can also find me over there on the Instagram at MRushing. So
you're kind of everywhere. You're like the Jeffrey Combs of social media now, aren't you?
Well, I mean, I wish. But, Chris, I mean, when you're not trying to figure out when your next merging with the female changeling is going to be, where can we find you?
I think that's illegal here right now, Matthew. I'm not sure.
Not in Japan. Chris, nothing's illegal in Japan.
Oh, everything goes here. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, actually, dancing was illegal here until recently, but that's for another
really?
Time.
Really? Wow.
They had no dancing law in Tokyo. So.
Wow, that's, yeah.
Find out about that. Actually, coming up, the next episode of my non-Star Trek podcast called Metropolis On Air we actually talk a little bit about that weird law. And that's going to be coming up here next week. Maybe by the time when this episode comes out, it'll be next week. That episode will drop, but you can find out if you want to listen to that podcast. So speaking of that podcast, go to iTunes, look for Metropolis On Air, or you can go to my website, the website of my magazine, metropolisjapan.com, and you'll find it there as well. Now, if you want to send me messages, the places to find me are in social media on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. Also on Facebook, that's my username. You can find me in the Babel Conference as well. And you can find my personal website at cbrianjones.com. There are a couple of cool videos up there now, Matthew. Last week on Thursday and Friday, I was together with these Polish videographers, Chris and Kasia. They do this vlog called the Uwaga Pies. That's U-W-A-G-A P-I-E-S, Pies. And they have this huge YouTube channel, and it's a daily vlog about life in Tokyo. And we did some really interesting stuff last week, including going to the Kawaii, which means cute, Kawaii Monster Cafe in Harajuku. And the video from that, if you go to my website, cbrianjones.com, you can actually see me there in those videos. But really interesting stuff going on, but that's what you'll find there on that site. And then elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing the Ready Room with other hosts and special guests. The last episode that we recorded, Larry Nemechek is co-hosting with me again. And we had a really interesting time there talking about bounty and Tellarites. So Matthew, with your NX01 hat on today, you're in the right time period for that discussion about Tellarites in the 22nd century. And then you can find me doing Hyperchannel from time to time as well. Also, go over to the official website, StarTrek.com. You can find my column there called Trekspectives. I put a new one out last week called An Enterprising Approach to TNG, where I take one episode per season of The Next Generation and imagine what they would have been like if they did three episode arcs as they did in the fourth season of Enterprise. So those are all the places that you can find me if you're interested in more of my ramblings about Star Trek and other stuff.
Well, of course we are, Chris. So yeah, definitely check that out, especially at StarTrek.com. That was a really fun article. I had a great time reading that and would have loved to have seen some of that on TNG. Cool. But this is not Earl Grey. So
speaking of one of those guys. Actually, here's another reason to go read it. Preemptive Strike. I say in the article, imagine if that had been a 5-episode arc, 2 on DS9, 3 on TNG, using both casts in all 5 episodes to tell the story of the Maquis.
Epic! It would have been. That's really what epic. It would have been. Would be epic.
Really, yeah. Would have been. Oh, and man. We could have had Ro and Kira together.
Oh, man. Jeez. Gold. That is solid gold there.
It would have been gold. Solid gold. One more thing before we go. We want to say thank you to our production team here. Of course, our executive producers, one of whom is Mr. Matthew Rushing right here, along with Norm Lau. Also, our associate producers, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp, and our network production manager, Richard Marquez, who gets all the shows out to you guys every day of the week. And of course, Will Wynn is also our content manager here on the network. So thank you so much to everyone there. And thank you, Ruth, Will, and Ken, for supporting us as associate producers and supporting us through Patreon. We are a listener-supported network. We do need your help to stay on the air. So if you would like to help out as well, please go check out patreon.com/trekfm, and you can get all the information there about how you can contribute to the network, help us cover the costs of production, hosting, distribution, everything that goes into the shows. So thank you everyone who supports us there. We have so many great patrons. Again, that's patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.